morning.
And that has been accomplished. Is it Mr. Papik?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jonathan Papik. I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Brian J. Adams. The issue raised by this case is who, under the Nebraska Constitution, has the authority to decide whether those convicted of crimes under Nebraska law should receive parole. This is an issue of consequence to Mr. Adams because under a Nebraska statute, section 83.1110, he and other prisoners serving life sentences are ineligible for parole. The counsel for the Attorney General's office representing the Board of Parole in this matter has taken the position, and this is the position that was adopted by the district court, that the legislature can permissibly limit those offenders eligible for parole. Mr. Adams' position, on the other hand, that the text, structure, and history of Article 4, Section 13 of the Nebraska Constitution gives the parole board, and the parole board alone, with two limited exceptions set forth in that provision for offenders convicted of treason and impeachment, the authority to decide who should receive parole, and that therefore 83.1110 is unconstitutional. The text of Article...
Counsel. Yes. Isn't the issue determinate versus indeterminate sentences? Because a life sentence, just life sentence, is a determinate sentence. If a district judge gave someone 10 to 10, for example, that would be a determinate sentence, and those people wouldn't be paroled either, would they?
Yes, that is the issue raised by the statute.
You really want is no everyone from day one they walk into prison is parole eligible, right?
That would be the effect. I mean, our position is that parole eligibility is set forth in Article 4, Section 13. And all Article 4, Section 13, it says any offense except for treason and impeachment. And so, yes, anyone would be eligible for parole because the requirements are set out in the Constitution. That's textually committed to the executive branch, to an entity, the Board of Parole, and the legislature is not permitted to add to or subtract from. What the text says, and I'll read it, is Article 4, Section 13 provides that the Board of Parole shall have power to grant paroles after conviction and judgment under such conditions as may be prescribed by law for any offenses committed against the criminal laws of this state except treason and impeachment. Several things to be noted in that text. First, the spelling out that exceptions for treason and impeachment. The Constitution specifically says these two categories of offenses are off limits for parole. And under principles of statutory interpretation and constitutional interpretation, when specific exceptions are noted to a rule, it rules out the possibility of other exceptions. There's a case we cited in our brief, Conroy, that this case decided that arose in the tax context where the court reached that conclusion. Also notable is the fact that the Constitution uses the word any. It sets out that any offenses other than those two are eligible for parole, signifying that literally any other offense is parole eligible. Now, the state has argued and the district court has argued that the language that says under such conditions as may be prescribed by law gives the legislature the power to set any limits that they desire for parole eligibility. And there's several reasons that are set forth in our brief and that I would articulate today as to why that's not the case. First, conditions in the clemency context is a term of art that would be used to describe those, for example, for a person that's granted parole, your conditions of parole are those conditions that you have to abide by after you're granted parole to maintain your parole status. You're released, but there are conditions. You may have to report to your parole officer. You may have to maintain some sort of employment status. But that's what condition means in the context of parole.
Do we customarily characterize words used in the Constitution as terms of art in a narrow context?
I don't know that you specifically address that.
Do you have any authority for that proposition?
I don't have authority for that proposition, Your Honor, but it's the Constitution is a legal document just like a statute where you would, as my understanding of your principles of constitutional interpretation is that they largely mirror your principles of statutory interpretation. And if you had a statute that had a term of art, you'd certainly consider that in interpreting its meaning.
One of the former members of this court once characterized one of my arguments about a constitutional provision as a rather parsimonious view of the Constitution. How would you respond to that as to your argument?
I'm certainly not going to admit that I'm making a parsimonious argument, so I would deny that. One other issue related to conditions goes to the history of this provision. And as we cited in our brief, in 1949, to back up a step, in 1920, the constitutional provision that eventually led to today's Article 4, Section 13, was largely the same, aside for the fact that parole power was vested in the Board of Pardons. The Board of Pardons had the power to grant paroles, but the same language about under such conditions as prescribed by law was in the Constitution. And in 1949, the legislature was contemplating passing a law that would have required an offender to serve 20 years before they were eligible for clemency of any sort. And the legislature sought the guidance of the Attorney General's office as to whether that would be constitutional under the predecessor Article 4, Section 13. And the Attorney General's office issued an opinion that's cited in our brief that said, no, that cannot be what condition means. First, they point to the fact that the Constitution specifically set forth those categories of offenses that were off limits, treason and impeachment, and that the legislature couldn't otherwise limit what the Constitution set forth. Now, you know, in the ordinary case, an Attorney General's opinion, certainly not precedent, and I'm not arguing that to you today, but it's entitled to respectful consideration. But in this case, I think that Attorney General's opinion tells us something more, because when the Board of Parole was created by a constitutional amendment in 1969, the framers of the Constitution would have been well aware of that Attorney General's opinion. It was on the books. It said you can't add to or subtract from the power to grant paroles. This condition language doesn't grant that. But the response of the Constitutional Convention and the people of the state of Nebraska was not to, well, let's repeal this. Let's give the legislature the power to add to or set conditions. Just the opposite. In fact, they reenacted the provision, the only change being to give the power to the Board of Parole. And, you know, in your principles of constitutional interpretation, you're to look to what the people creating and ratifying the Constitution would have understood it to mean. And at that time, that provision was understood to mean that the legislature could not add to or subtract from parole eligibility. And yet that constitutional provision was adopted in much the same way as the Attorney General's office had interpreted it. One other issue I'd like to address, and this raises a question raised by Justice Kelch, and that has to do with this, I would consider it a parade of horribles argument that the state makes in their brief, and is raised by the question, well, does this mean that every offender is eligible for parole, you know, the day that they're sentenced? And while that is the argument, because the Constitution gives the power to the Board of Parole and sets only those limits set forth, I think it's important to remember that we're not arguing for unlimited paroles. This argument is only about who gets to decide. And the Board of Parole would certainly be within its rights to adopt rules about, you know, you have to serve 20 years, you have to serve 30 years, we're not going to consider indeterminate sentences, whatever they might choose to do. It's an issue of who has the authority. That authority has been committed to the Board of Parole, and the legislature can't add to it. If there are no other questions at this time, I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, good morning.
May it please the court, the issue in this case is who has the constitutional authority to determine when an inmate is parole ineligible. Is it the legislature or is it the Board of Parole? The appellant's challenge is a constitutional challenge to a statute, and the statute, like numerous other statutes, has the effect of establishing the condition of when an inmate is parole eligible. basic principles of constitutional construction are that statutes are presumed to be constitutional, and all reasonable doubts are to be resolved in favor of constitutionality. The appellant's argument, I would say, does not follow the law as far as analyzing constitutional claims. Rather, he argues for a narrowly defined context of constitutionality in which conditions prescribed by law, he does a very narrow definition, and his definition does not take into account the separation of powers in which this court has recognized in the voluntary sentencing guidelines who does have the authority to determine penalties for crimes, length of offender sentences, and general policy for criminal law, all of which I would say is consistent with the legislature having the power to determine when an individual is parole eligible.
And your argument is narrow, synonymous with parsimonious.
Yeah, exactly. I was listening. I would agree with, and Judge Kelch, I think, made a good point. The effect of his argument is that an inmate sentenced to prison would become parole eligible on the day he's sentenced.
Would that affect the legislature's mandates with regard to mandatory minimum sentences that are required to be served before you're parole eligible?
Yeah, I think the precedent that would be set would be the legislature has no authority to set mandatory minimums. The legislature has no authority to set good time laws, that all of which affect when people are parole eligible, just on and on and on. Interesting part of, and I think the voluntary sentencing guidelines case is probably the best precedent, in which the court says, as imprecise as the line may be on separation of powers, logic and case law dictate that it's the legislature's function through enactment of statutes to declare the law, public policy, and define crimes and punishments. The nature of defining a punishment and defining crimes and setting sentences includes when a person is going to be parole eligible.
Has the parole board itself ever sought the power to set parole eligibility guidelines?
Not sure I understand.
Have they ever sought to do what the legislature has done and said you're eligible for parole after a certain period of time?
To me, the parole board, at least what they've done historically, is that they recognize the legislature has essentially set the policy for when people are parole eligible. In other words, the parole board has, to my knowledge, never attempted to set a person free on parole sooner than when they were parole eligible under the statutes of the state of Nebraska, which to me was a recognition of what the power is, which is the power is with the legislature, not with the parole board to determine when a person is parole eligible.
Are we over-reading the claim here of the appellant in terms of the outcome that appellant seeks? In other words, looking at the Constitution, the argument is, here's who's not eligible for parole, if it's treason or impeachment.
To me, treason and impeachment is simply the legislature is without the authority to establish parole eligibility by statute for those classes.
For those classes. But that's a little different. That's the nature of the crime. But that's different than when eligibility commences.
I would agree with that. The nature of the crime, they limit legislate the Constitution.
It's the nature of the crime thing. It's not a chronology.
I'm not sure what you mean by chronology.
It doesn't necessarily speak, does it or does it not, to when eligibility commences. Not who's eligible, but when eligibility commences.
To me, if there was a crime of treason in which a sentence is imposed, the legislature, to me, would not have the power to pass a statute or parole eligibility for that particular crime.
Because of the constitutional
Because
principle.
Of the Constitution.
Right.
But as far as the conditions prescribed for law for all other crimes,
right.
I would say when a person is parole eligible for all other crimes would be a matter that the legislature could pass.
Would be within their power.
Would
but
be
it,
with,
when doesn't necessarily flow from those two constitutional provisions. That's just categories of stuff that's off the table.
I understand your point. Yes, that's exactly right. Yes, it's the nature of the crime is not necessarily when. It's just a restriction on
that's
the power.
So in your view, that's as far as that gets you by referring to the Constitution.
Yes.
Categories off the table.
Yes.
That does not answer when or who could set time frames.
Exactly. Exactly. I agree. I agree as far as on as far as how you define conditions. It doesn't involve treason. It doesn't involve impeachment.
Could you address the Attorney General's opinions that the panel relies upon?
Well, I guess I was somewhat embarrassed to say that when I read that they were relying upon Attorney General's opinions, I didn't think I had that much authority, so I didn't spend a lot of time analyzing that. Because I did, my review did reflect that the Attorney General's office had gone back and forth and flip-flopped over time and appears now to have adopted the position that's similar to what I'm arguing now, but I guess I've never viewed Attorney General's opinion as far as arguing in front of the Supreme Court as anything.
Well, I guess the argument is at the time, was it 1969, that there was an Attorney General opinion saying thus and so, which would have informed the legislature.
Yeah, and it's part of our policy is when we see opinions that we can wrong and the changes are supposed to, and that appears to be what did happen, that the Attorney General's office did back away from its prior views and essentially changed its position. But again, I don't know that that's, I don't think I've ever cited the Attorney General's opinion in the Supreme Court. Unless the court has other questions, we would ask that the court affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal?
We have a minute and 3 seconds.
A minute and 3 seconds, Mr. Babbitt.
Just to be clear on the Attorney General's opinions, you know, we're not saying Attorney General's opinions are precedent. The argument is, as Justice Miller Lerman articulated, the argument is there's an Attorney General's opinion on the books. Time the constitutional amendment was adopted, and the opinion of the highest legal office in the state would seem to be persuasive as to how the constitutional provision, the meaning of it, was understood.
At the time of creation of legislation.
At the time the constitutional provision was adopted, and then the subsequent legislation creating the board.
That was the AG opinion at that point, in that time frame.
Second, on the separation of powers issue, if I could briefly address that, any form of clemency is going to be a limit on the legislature's power to set terms of punishment. The legislature sentences someone to 25 years and the Board of Pardons decides to issue a pardon. That's always going to be something where the Board of Pardons is shortening a legislatively imposed sentence. And so my argument would be that, you know, just because the legislature is empowered to set punishment, that doesn't take away the power that the Constitution has granted to boards of parole and pardons.
Pardons, however, are distinguishable and are entrusted not to the Board of Parole, but to the Board of Pardons.
Sure. Right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments for the day. The court is adjourned and you are excused.
Second, I'll be there.